Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we are going to do a little more from The Complete Stories of Saki. I'm Alex Linder. Everything that we do can be found at vnnforum.com. You can follow me at @A_Linder on Twitter. And if you listen to our first talk about Hector Human Roe is a British, I guess, closeted homosexual who was Hector Human Roe, M-U-N-R-O, born in Burma, was in the military police like George Orwell and went to write for a paper, and he wrote a whole bunch of short stories, some of the best written in the English language, and I have a copy of his complete stories. We did the first one last time. We're going to do a few more. We're doing the Reginald ones, and this is sort of a, I guess, sort of an alter ego or a young dandy or aesthete or a languorous, lazy young man who's kind of showing you how to be a homosexual. Be in the closet if you've got to be a sexual degenerate and never bring that nasty stuff out front. Content yourself with showing by exterior signs of superior taste that maybe you have eccentricities in other areas if you have to do such a thing. Now, this might be a little off course for most nationalists, but it's still wonderful writing. I enjoy reading it, and I'm trying to convey a little bit of that to you, whether or not, regardless of how we feel about the writer or the subject matter. It's still very good stuff, and we can learn from it. And that's what the Learning College is all about in Vanguard Audiobooks. And this is what I want to talk about right now. This is what we're going to talk about. These are fairly brief stories. Most of them are maybe a few hundred or a couple thousand words. And they're meant to kind of create almost like a little, they're little bits that happen, but altogether they give you a picture of this character of his called Reginald. Used to associate that with black names, but originally it's I think it's an old Germanic name, but certainly used in England. But anyway, last time to start off with, we did the first one that is just simply called Reginald, and now we move on to the second one, Reginald on Christmas Presents. I don't know how many we'll do, but we'll do two or three maybe, depending on how quick they go and how much we have to discuss. Before we start, a listener informed me that he believes that the marron glacés that I speculated was some kind of glazed cookie may actually be chestnuts. I still haven't looked it up, but I'm guessing that he's correct. Not sure about the glazed part, but some kind of delicacy that they might serve at an upper-end party there in England. And these stories take place in Edwardian times, which is the brief period from 1900 to 1910, or somewhat extended to 1914, the onset of the Great War that changed European civilization forever. Some say destroyed it. Anyway, so these take place in upper-crust or elite-level Edwardian society. Reginald on Christmas Presents, Hector Hugh Monroe, Complete Stories of Saki. And on the front cover, there's a picture of a fellow with kind of an odd look in his face. Fairly prominent brow crease lines between his eyebrows, of blue eyes, a sort of, I'm not sure how you'd characterize, I'd have to think long and hard about how to characterize the look on this kind of a caricature. Hair parted in the middle, brillantined or slicked back. A sort of maybe just slightly this edge of baleful, but then he has his hand, his kind of upturned palm with his fingers curled back and clutching a cigarette in his right hand, and then his left hand is on his hip, akimbo. So slightly challenging, not in a football linebacker kind of way, but in an aesthete, homosexual, or highly cultivated dandy kind of a way. But there's not a weak look in his face. He's just obviously not a super buff built man, but more of a refined sort of a man about to say something, to flick his ash and say something critical, kind of waspy or catty out of the side of his mouth, perhaps. That's how I take it. Reginald on Christmas Presents. "I wish it to be distinctly understood," said Reginald, "that I don't want a George, Prince of Wales, prayer book as a Christmas present. The fact cannot be too widely known. There ought, he continued, to be a technical education class on the science of present giving. No one seems to have the faintest notion of what anyone else wants, and the prevalent ideas on the subject are not creditable to a civilized community. Again, it's kind of the high and low, the talking down, and the joyous sort of condescension of the natural-born superior, which Mencken says about the finest thing a man can have is a sort of naturally superior air, because people naturally grovel to it because they feel small in themselves. It's just kind of a funny way of looking at things. But he sort of, if I have to explain it, it does sometimes kind of kill it, but bear with me. It's one of those things a little bit where if you can't grasp it, no one can really teach you. I can teach you the meaning of individual words. I can teach you how to avoid grammatical errors. I can't teach you how to write effectively. You kind of either know that or you don't. If you don't have any positive, then you have to concentrate on avoiding the negative. And I've used this analogy in sports, where in soccer, I did not have any striking ability with my feet. Even though many times I was called to play forward, by not having any attacking ability, as I have the attacking ability in writing, so I naturally attack. But in soccer, I did not have the attacking ability, so I preferred to play defense, where you don't need great talent, you just need to avoid errors. And so it is in writing. You can teach someone how to avoid errors so that their writing may be understood. What you can't do is communicate any particular genius to them for expression, any particular mellifluity or mellifluousness or poetic quality. Those are gifts. Now, but of course, you know, for ordinary purposes, avoiding errors is far more than the what the average person can do these days. You know that. Anyway, so Reginald is going off about what he doesn't want for Christmas and how there ought to be a class teaching people how to give gifts correctly and the right stuff to give. There is, for instance, the female relative in the country who knows a tie is always useful and sends you some spotted horror that you would only wear in secret or in Tottenham Court Road. See, that's how a writer communicates a nice insult wrapped in a deeper point or deeper insult. The side insults are always especially vicious because they're so unexpected. When you break, this is a technical matter for writers, when you break, you're insulting one group of people and you throw out as an obiter dictum or a side point, a side opinion that seems unrelated. It might even actually be the real point you're going for. It just comes as particularly unexpected because it sucker punches the reader who is perceiving the insult directed at the initial target and doesn't see the other one coming. Delightful. So maybe his whole point is to slam Tottenham. Now, of course, I don't know what that means. Maybe it means some particular neighborhood where there's a bunch of undignified people. I don't know. But you don't need to know because you get his point. The Edwardian equivalent of a trailer park in terms of the taste of the citizens, of the inhabitants. Denizens is a good word for people you wish to slightly disrespect. The denizens of Tottenham Court Road. Anyway, that's an example of a professional insult, writer's insult. It might have been useful had she kept it to tie up currant bushes with, you know, like currant. You know what currants are, like something like raisins almost, type of raisin sort of thing that you stick in bread. You could use the tie that this female relative in the country would send you to tie up raisin bushes, essentially, when it would have served the double purpose of supporting the branches and frightening away the birds. For it is an admitted fact that the ordinary tomtit of commerce has a sounder aesthetic taste than the average female relative in the country. Now that's brilliant, right? You're saying the birds are flying away from it not because it's flapping, but because they have superior taste and they're horrified by how gauche this tie is that seems so appealing to the female relative in the country. He's basically doing the rural city distinction is not a Jew-made thing. It's a Jew-built-upon thing, as they defame Southerners or rurals. But the rural city divide is always, they're in the basic word. Urban means civilized, urbane, and pagan or bucolic means uncivilized, rural. You see. And that stereotype has existed since Roman times. The ordinary tomtit, that's a kind of bird, a little bird of commerce, has a sounder aesthetic taste than the average female relative in the country. Then there are aunts, or he'd say aunts. They are always a difficult class to deal with in the matter of presence. The trouble is that one never catches them really young enough. By the time one has educated them to an appreciation of the fact that one does not wear red woolen mittens in the West End, they die or quarrel with the family or do something else equally inconsiderate. That is why the supply of trained aunts is always so precarious. Funny thing, the treatment of death as something one, as a choice one makes rather than something that happens to one. And in considering someone else's death as an inconvenience to you is funny, inherently. And that's fairly common, though. It's not as good as the other one, but it's still decent. Then there is my aunt Agatha, par example, who sent me a pair of gloves last Christmas and even got so far as to choose a kind that was being worn and had the correct number of buttons. They're more or less in the style of the times. The cool people. But they were nines. I sent them to a boy whom I hated intimately. He didn't wear them, of course, but he could have. And that was where the bitterness of death came in. It was nearly as consoling as sending white flowers to his funeral. Notice how he's continually insults by way of inferior taste flowing both ways. Of course, I wrote and told my aunt that they were the one thing that had been wanting to make existence blossom like a rose. I'm afraid she thought me frivolous. She comes from the north, where they live in the fear of heaven and the Earl of Dunham, or not Lena Dunham, but Durham, where they live in the fear of heaven and the Earl of Durham. Reginald affects an exhaustive knowledge of things political, which furnishes an excellent excuse for not discussing them. Aunts with a dash of foreign extraction in them are the most satisfactory in the way of understanding these things. Now he's treating his aunts like something you would select or train or prepare for, or something you would pick rather than something you simply have. But if you can't choose your aunt, it is wisest in the long run to choose the present and send her the bill. Again, always with an eye toward operating other people for his own advantage. Even friends of one's own set, who might be expected to know better, have curious delusions on the subject. I'm not collecting copies of the cheaper editions of Omar Khayyam, the Rubaiyat, right? I gave the last four that I received to the lift boy, and I like to think of him reading them with Fitzgerald's notes to his aged mother. Lift boys always have aged mothers, show such nice feeling on their part, I think. And that part might as well have been cribbed directly from Oscar Wilde. It's exactly the sort of thing he would and did say. Personally, I can't see where the difficulty in choosing suitable presents lies. No boy who had brought himself up properly could fail to appreciate one of those decorative bottles of liqueurs that are so reverently staged in Morel's window, and it wouldn't matter in the least if one got duplicates. And there would always be the supreme moment of dreadful uncertainty whether it was creme de menthe or chartreuse, like the expectant thrill on seeing your partner's hand turned up at bridge. People may say what they like about the decay of Christianity. The religious system that produced green chartreuse can never really die. And again, he's putting forward an idea here. Is it in jest? He's saying that rather than give someone a shitty, bad taste tie or something that's the wrong size or not current or a cheap edition of work someone has, give them something they can actually use, liquor. Right? Is that good? Is that wise? Is that true? Is that what people really want? Maybe it is. Maybe if you have to give people gifts and you wonder what to get them, maybe Reginald's right that what they really would appreciate is liquor. So you expand your world and you don't know if he's right or if this is just a saucy character thinking it. Is that what the average person thinks? I don't know. Kind of makes you wonder though, doesn't it? And then, of course, there are liqueur glasses and crystallized fruits and tapestry curtains and heaps of other necessities of life that make really sensible presents. Notice how he's, again, he's inverting the normal order of things. Those would be the least, the farthest from necessities. Hence the thing that is closest to the person who's the farthest from the norm. They would be the necessities to the foppish, to the dandy, to the aesthete. And they would be farthest from the norm for the normal person. So it's an inversion of ordinary values. Liquor glasses and crystallized fruits and tapestry curtains, he calls necessities. Necessities that make really sensible presents. Not to speak of luxuries, such as having one's bills paid. Again, this is nearly directly from Wilde. Exactly the same sort of thing that Wilde would say. Not to speak of luxuries, such as having one's bills paid. And remember, you'll see this sort of thing echo through the culture for decades and decades. And remember, it was a... Oh, what was the ad with Brooke Shields in it? If I have money, I buy Calvin Klein's. And if I have anything left over, I pay my rent. Or I buy food or something like that. So once a technique is known or discovered, it reverberates and echoes through the culture. And most of what is originality... You can't even trace it to the person who originally conceived it. It's just an emendation or an application of this technique in new and different circumstances by new and different people. You know, back in 1890, it would have been Oscar Wilde saying this, perhaps for the first time, perhaps not. But in 1905 or whenever this was, it would be Saki saying it after Wilde. Perhaps because of Wilde, because it's close enough, it could be taken almost bodily from him. Not to speak of luxuries. So the necessities are the liquor glasses, liqueur glasses, not liquor, liqueur glasses, and crystallized fruits, and tapestry curtains, and heaps of other necessities of life that make really sensible presents. Not to speak of luxuries, such as having one's bills paid, or getting something quite sweet in the way of jewelry. And remember, poor Hitler, when he had no money and was in Austria and his parents had died or left him, he would choose between eating and buying a book to read to understand, enlarge the scope of his understanding, and he would choose the book, shivering away there in his men's rental room in his boarding house. That's the kind of man he was. It's another parallel to it, right? What matters to you? What's your necessity? What's your luxury? How do you define those? Unlike the alleged good woman of the Bible, I'm not above rubies. When found, by the way, she must have been rather a problem at Christmas time. Nothing short of a blank check would have fitted the situation. Perhaps it's as well that she's died out. The great charm about me, concluded Reginald, is that I am so easily pleased. And that reminds me of, what's that line? I'm always pleased, the best will always suit me just fine. Or it was said a little more elegantly than that, but that was the basic idea. Again, you see another variation on this theme, another permutation of it. Now, the great charm about me, concluded Reginald, is that I'm so easily pleased. I'm always satisfied with the best, I would put in there. But I draw the line at a Prince of Wales prayer book, he says. Concluding that second story, Reginald on Christmas gifts, Christmas presents. Next one is Reginald on the Academy. So you see how this is kind of like imagine it like little scenes in a movie, and Reginald kind of, you could really almost film it. You'd have to have an announcer, I guess, but Reginald dressed as David Hyde Pierce is, I think, the way you want to kind of think of this guy. Probably not real large, somewhat slight. Exceedingly well-dressed, as Oscar Wilde said, you can never be over-educated or over-dressed. And talking to the camera and delivering you his insights, right? That would work, I think. Reginald on the Academy. One goes to the Academy in self-defense, said Reginald. It is the one topic one has in common with the country cousins. It is almost a religious observance with them, said the other, a kind of artistic mecca. And when the good ones die, they go to the chantry bequest. The mystery is what they find to talk about in the country. Again, that escapes me, some of those references there. There are two subjects of conversation in the country, servants and can fowls be made to pay? See, again, they're mocking the rural people and they're what they talk about. The first, I believe, is compulsory. The second is optional. As a function, resumed Reginald, the academy is a failure. You think it would be tolerable without the pictures? The pictures are all right in their way. After all, one can always look at them if one is bored with one's surroundings, or one wants to avoid an imminent acquaintance. Even that doesn't always save one. There is the inevitable female whom you met once in Devonshire or the Matopo Hills or somewhere, who charges up to you with the remark that it's funny how one always meets people one knows at the academy. Personally, I don't think it's funny. I don't think it funny. I suffered in that way just now, said Reginald plaintively, from a woman whose word I had to take that she had not met me last, that she had met me last summer in Brittany. That's the province in France closest to the, on the English Channel, just across from Britain. I hope you are not too brutal. I merely told her with engaging simplicity that the art of life was the avoidance of the unattainable. Did she try and work it out in the back of her catalog? So this would be the academy where they're showing, they're having like a display of paintings, I believe. Did she try and work it out in the back of her catalog? No, not there and then. She murmured something about being so clever. Fancy coming to the academy to be clever. To be clever in the afternoon argues that one is dining nowhere in the evening. Again, that could be straight from Wilde. Completely Wildean. Which reminds me that I can't remember whether I accepted an invitation from you to dine at Kettner's tonight. On the other hand, I can remember with startling distinctness not having asked you to. So much certainty is unbecoming in the young, so we'll consider that settled. Again, very, very Wildean. What were you talking about? Oh, pictures. Personally, I rather like them. They are so refreshingly real and probable. They take one away from the unrealities of life. Again, the sort of, I would say in that case, sort of cheap paradox characteristic of the less good Wild. But very, very Wildean, completely Wildean, all this. One likes to escape from oneself occasionally. That is the disadvantage of a portrait as a rule. One's bitterest friends can find nothing more to ask than the faithful unlikeness that goes down to posterity as oneself. I hate posterity. It's so fond of having the last word. Of course, as regards portraits, there are exceptions. For instance, to die before being painted by Sargent is to go to heaven prematurely. With the necessary care and impatience, and impatience, you may avoid that catastrophe. If you're going to be rude, said Reginald, I shall dine with you tomorrow night as well. The chief vice of the academy, he continued, is its nomenclature. Why, for instance, should an obvious trout stream with a palpable rabbit sitting in the foreground be called an evening dream of unbeclouded peace, or something of that sort? You think, said the other, that a name should economize description rather than stimulate imagination? Well, properly chosen, it should do both. There's my lady kitten at home, for instance. I've called it Dairy. Well, suggest nothing to my imagination but protracted sieges and religious animosities. Of course, I don't know your kitten. Oh, you're silly. It's a sweet name, and it answers to it when it wants to. Then, if there are any unseemly noises in the night, they can be explained succinctly. Dairy and Tom's. That, I have a feeling, is a joke that escapes me, because you kind of have to know some of the English references that he's making, and many of them escape me because I don't know. They're too local to that time and place. You might almost charge for the advertisement, but as applied to pictures, don't you think your system would be too subtle for, say, the country cousins? Every reformation must have its victims. You can't expect the fatted calf to share the enthusiasm of the angels over the prodigal's return. Return of the Prodigal Son. Again, this would be a biblical stuff that everybody would know, right? Even today, most people would probably pick up on that. They kill the father kills the fatted calf when the prodigal son returns home. You can't expect the fatted calf to share the enthusiasm of the angels over the prodigal's return. Another darling weakness of the Academy is that none of its luminaries must arrive in a hurry. You can see them coming for years, like a Balkan trouble. Again, that's where the First World War started, right? Or a street improvement. And by the time they have painted 1,000 or so square yards of canvas, their work begins to be recognized. Someone who, in capital letters, must not be contradicted, said that a man must be a success by the time he's 30, or never. To have reached 30, said Reginald, is to have failed in life. Right? Young, dandy, good-looking. You very much get the sense of queer, liking the looks. And, of course, you know who it was who said, man must be a success by the time he's 30 or never. That would be Oscar Wilde. This is very, very Wildean. And that was Reginald on the Academy. And now, why don't we do another one? The next one is Reginald at the Theater. After all, said the Duchess vaguely, there are certain things you can't get away from. Right and wrong, good conduct, and moral rectitude have certain well-defined limits. So, for the matter of that, replied Reginald, has the Russian Empire. The trouble is that the limits are not always in the same place. Clever, huh? Yeah. Reginald and the Duchess regarded each other with mutual distrust, tempered by scientific interest. Reginald considered that the Duchess had much to learn, in particular not to hurry out of the Carlton as though afraid of losing one's last bus. A woman, he said, who is careless of disappearances is capable of leaving town before Goodwood and dying at the wrong moment of an unfashionable disease. Again, we're doing the Wildean thing of taking something and turning it on its head. You know, your normal phrase would be a woman would be careful of appearances, and he's saying a woman would be careless of disappearances. This is how it's often like in country music. They'll take some stock phrase, stock idiom, and they'll twist one of the terms of it and come up with a new song. Very, very common. This is the nature of a lot of originality is emendation or subtle altering or treating the terms as, you know, kind of like the way that, you know, if you have a, that's not a good analogy. All words are composed of letters. There's only 26 letters. There's only a few thousand words commonly used. And even these words are paired up beyond words. We don't have a word for that other than like a cliche where stuff is fitted into... This adjective is normally coupled with this noun. Now, when you vary that, it subtly disturbs people without confusing them because they pick up what you're meaning, but they have to just stop long enough to ponder what is changed about the slightly different adjective that you used. And this is the way that you draw them into thinking without putting them off by being so radically weird and new that they just, it blips in and out of their mind or bounces off it, you see. But now we're reading for enjoyment. So we notice how we're trying to talk a little about how the artist achieves his effects. A woman who is careless of disappearances is capable of leaving town before Goodwood, I don't know what Goodwood is, and of dying at the wrong moment of an unfashionable disease. Again, you see that the way that ants are treated as a choice, dying is treated as something that is a fashion statement, as we saw in the earlier stuff. It's all of a piece. The Duchess thought that Reginald did not exceed the ethical standard which circumstances demanded, which is a oblique or reverse way of saying she's not liking, she's saying he's not being, he's not acting the way he should. Of course, she resumed combatively, it's the prevailing fashion to believe in perpetual change. See, they're arguing about moral relativism versus moral absolutism. Remember, this is around the time of just after Nietzsche and God is dead and people are doubting morality and you're about to have Einstein and theory of relativity and that just as we saw with Newton and that stuff feeding into the Enlightenment, so it was with relativity, moral relativity. The Duchess thought that Reginald did not exceed the ethical standard which circumstances demanded. "Of course," she resumed combatively, "it's the prevailing fashion to believe in perpetual change and mutability and all that sort of thing, and to say we are all merely an improved form of primeval ape. Of course you subscribe to that doctrine." "I think it decidedly premature. In most people I know, the process is far from complete." So again, you want to confuse and baffle and excite and intrigue people, differ from their expectations of how you shall respond to what they say. Right? Willy Wonka, walking down the steps, one at a time, then back, then down, then back, then down, then back. And they don't know what he's going to do, and they're very excited by it. She thought he was going to subscribe to one point of view, a very modern view, and he said, "Well, I don't think they've even finished evolving from apes." "And equally, of course, you are quite irreligious." "Oh, by no means. The fashion just now is a Roman Catholic frame of mind with an agnostic conscience. You get the medieval picturesqueness of the one with the modern conveniences of the other." And that's the idea of the religion is something you choose off for style reasons, something that you choose off of a menu. But really, religion is what that dead pop-eyed black dude says in Bad Santa. "This ain't no Chinese menu. This is pricks fixed. You either all or nothing. You don't get to pick and choose, like cafeteria style, when it comes to absolute truths." Religion claims to present to you. The fashion, anyway, enjoy this. So, "and of course you are equally, of course, you are quite irreligious." "Oh, by no means. The fashion just now is a Roman Catholic frame of mind with an agnostic conscience. You get the medieval picturesqueness of the one with the modern conveniences of the other." So he's being kind of a smartass in a formalized way. And you know, women don't really like that because it's kind of, women are very, very prone to conformity and basically lack imagination and think things ought to measure up to whatever the particular standards. A lot of women are like that. So he's having fun with her and kind of teasing and poking fun at her in a way. Either it would be teasing banter if she were someone he were attracted to, but it would be mildly obnoxious to her if she's someone he doesn't like. The Duchess suppressed a sniff. She was one of those people who regard the Church of England with patronizing affection, as if it were something that had grown up in their kitchen garden. "But there are other things," she continued, "which I suppose are to a certain extent sacred even to you. Patriotism, for instance, an empire, an imperial responsibility, and blood is thicker than water, and all that sort of thing." Reginald waited for a couple minutes before replying, while the Lord of Rimini, temporarily monopolized the acoustic possibilities of the theater. Now again, this is to me, I like this way of writing. You understand Reginald's thoughts and interactions are more, well, the Lord of Rimini temporarily monopolized the acoustic possibilities of the theater. They are talking while the actual performance is going on, and their talking is what matters, and the guy who's actually there running out the hall and singing is a mere sidelight to their silly little conversation. You see, that's funny. But if you can't understand why it's funny, I can't explain it to you. It's, again, the reversal of the expected, the reversal of the normal. They're portraying this professional, probably some kind of opera or classical music, as mere backdrop to their silly exchange of barbs or wittiness. Their persiflage or badinage are a couple of terms for kind of witty banter. This isn't precisely witty banter. It's witty on his part. Slightly obnoxious. And I'm not really entirely sure what her motivation is. You'd have to know her age, but she's probably older and more formal, but she doesn't come off totally stiff. She comes off somewhat, probably more 40-ish, I would say. And he's more like, that's how I'm picturing it. Lord of Rimini temporarily monopolize the acoustic, like he's there to share it with them rather than perform. They're supposed to be listening. All right. That is the worst of a tragedy, he observed. One can't always hear oneself talk. And very, very Wildian. I put my talent into my work, and I put my genius into my life, and he was said to be one of the best talkers who ever lived, so far as anyone could know that, but not hearing oneself talk. Now, that would be taken by the average person as extremely egotistic, which it may be, but still, this is aspect of humanity. By no means identical with faggotry, but often found in fags. Anyway, it's not down to earth. It's something that's anti-natural. Hence, the green carnation movement was a symbol of dandyism. And they would put a green carnation because they were for everything artificial and against everything natural. Now, and that's why, like a girl would say, I'm a girly girl versus like a country girl or a girl who likes outside stuff. These would be the equivalent in men. They don't like the outside roughhousing boy stuff. They like the refined indoor civilized stuff, urbane, raffiniert. I think that would be in German, probably taken from French. Anyway. That is the worst of a tragedy, he observed. One can't always hear oneself talk. Of course I accept the imperial idea and the responsibility. After all, I would just as soon think in continents as anywhere else. And someday, when the season is over and we have the time, you shall explain to me the exact blood brotherhood and all that sort of thing that exists between a French Canadian and a mild Hindu and a Yorkshireman, for instance. Now, he's making fun of the claims of the British Empire and saying that all these people may be in the British Empire, but they're very different people. And he's mocking her by saying, well, you can go ahead and explain to me how those are all related. Oh, well, dominion over palm and pine, you know, quoted the Duchess hopefully. Of course, we mustn't forget that we're all part of the great Anglo-Saxon Empire, which for its part is rapidly becoming a suburb of Jerusalem. A very pleasant suburb, I admit, and quite a charming Jerusalem, but still a suburb. Now that would be a reference to Jews taking over the British Empire, it sounds like to me. And you could find the same kind of thing said, as I've mentioned, in the works of Henry Adams, The Education of Henry Adams, talking about Jews, and F. Scott Fitzgerald writing about sleek, quick Jews taking over the U.S., rising as the wasps fell apart. Really, to be told one's living in a suburb and one is conscious of spreading the benefits of civilization all over the globe. Philanthropy, I suppose you will say that is a comfortable delusion. And yet even you must admit that wherever want or misery or starvation is known to exist, however distant or difficult of access, we instantly organize relief on the most generous scale and distribute it, if need be, to the uttermost ends of the earth. This is a self-righteous Victorian Christianity. This is their attitude, and what's he going to say to it? The Duchess paused with a sense of ultimate triumph. She had made the same observation at a drawing-room meeting, and it had been extremely well received, you know, by the right thinkers and the sanctimonious and the people who were bothered by departure from customary verbal formulae, as Paul Fussell, as I said in his class from 1984. So the woman receiving the certain response one area expects the same response here, but she can't read this fellow well enough to tell that he's going to make fun of her slightly or largely. And she should be wise enough to pick up that that's what he's going to do. I wonder, said Reginald, if you have ever walked down the embankment on a winter night. Gracious, no, child. Why do you ask? I didn't. I only wondered. And even your philanthropy, practiced in a world where everything is based on competition, must have a debit as well as a credit account. The young ravens cry for food and are fed. Exactly, which presupposes that something else is fed upon. Oh, you're simply exasperating. You've been reading Nietzsche till you haven't got any sense of moral proportion left. May I ask if you are governed by any laws of conduct whatsoever? Well, there are certain fixed rules that one observes for one's own comfort. For instance, never be flippantly rude to any inoffensive gray-bearded stranger that you may meet in pine forests or hotel smoking rooms on the continent. It always turns out to be the King of Sweden. The restraint must be dreadfully irksome to you. When I was younger, boys of your age used to be nice and innocent. Now she's mocking him. The restraint must be dreadfully irksome. That's his one moral principle, is not to be flippant to inoffensive gray-bearded strangers because they turn out to be the King of Sweden. The restraint must be dreadfully irksome to you. When I was a younger, boys of your age used to be nice and innocent. Now we are, says Reginald, we are only nice. One must specialize in these days. Which reminds me of the man I read of in some sacred book who was given a choice of what he most desired. And because he didn't ask for titles and honors and dignities, but only for immense wealth, these other things came to him also. So he's saying that your class only values money. Money is your god. I'm sure you didn't read about him in any sacred book. Oh yes, I fancy you'll find him in Debrett. Debrett is like the Book of Peerages. It's like the book of the who's who or the social elite of England. The England kings and queens and royalty, and I guess the top noblemen. And so that's a very nicely turned part there. The part about the King of Sweden is very, very nicely turned. And you have to understand that he was making kind of the point that the Southerners used to make about the sanctimonious madmen, the abolitionists, who pretended to care deeply about the blacks who were slaves in the South, but they didn't give a damn about the miserable lives of the just as effectively enslaved white factory workers living right in their own towns. And that's why he said, did you ever go walking on the embankment? He's saying, so you're all about charity in deepest, darkest Africa, but you don't give a damn about the people starving and homeless and outside on your own embankment here in England. And he's also saying you're also doing it not because you're so noble and high-minded, but because it's a way of showing off and competing with the other rich into how philosophy is just another arena of competition for you, and all that you guys ultimately value is money. I mean, he's not saying all that, but he's definitely implying it. And so let's do one more. That was we've done Reginald's on Christmas presents, Reginald on the Academy. That was Reginald at the theater, which I totally forgot to read the title of. These are all like one page of small text, 1 to 2 pages of small text. We'll do one last one that will be Reginald's peace poem. I'm writing a poem on peace, said Reginald, emerging from a sweeping operation through a tin of mixed biscuits, in whose depths a macaroon or two might yet be lurking, i.e. he's eating some finger food, some snack cookies. Something of the kind seems to have been attempted already, said the other, who was, you know, presumably the writer. Oh, I know, but I may never get the chance again. Besides, I've got a new fountain pen. I don't pretend to have gone on any very original lines in writing about peace. In writing about peace, the thing is to say what everybody else is saying, only to say it better. And those are the two parts of originality, something that is truly, genuinely sui generis or original, or something that is a emendation, a new way of putting an old thing, a new twist on an old form. I don't pretend to have gone on any very original lines. That's sort of an older way of saying it. People wouldn't put it like that nowadays. I don't pretend to have gone on any very original lines in writing about peace. No, I misintoned that. Semicolon. In writing about peace, the thing is to say what everybody else is saying, only to say it better. It begins with the usual ornithological emotion. Ornithology is the study of birds. When the widgeon westward winging, heard the folk farinagigging, heard the shouting and the singing. Farinagigging is good, but why widgeon? Why not? Anything that winged westward would naturally begin with a W. Need it wing westward? The bird must go somewhere. You wouldn't have it all hang about and look foolish. Then I brought in something about the heedless hartebeest galloping over the deserted veldt. Of course, you know, it's practically extinct in those regions. I can't help that. It gallops so nicely. I might make it have all sorts of unexpected yearnings. Mother, may I go in Mafic? Tear about in hindered traffic? Of course, you'll say there would be no traffic worth bothering about on the barren, sun-scorched veldt, but there's no other word that rhymes with Mafic. Seraphic? Reginald considered. It might do, but I've got a lot about angels later on. You must have angels in a peace poem. I know dreadfully little about their habits. They can do unexpected things like the hartebeest. Of course. Then I turn on London, the city of dreadful nocturnes, and resonant with hymns of joy and thanksgiving, colon, more of his lines, and the sleeper, eye unlidding, heard a voice forever bidding, much farewell to Dolly Gray. Turning weary on his truckle bed, he heard the honeysuckle lauded in apiarian lay. Longfellow at his best wrote nothing like that. Again, that insult as praise. That's one of those double entendres that could be taken either way. Longfellow at his best wrote, well, it's the best you've ever done. Doesn't mean it's good. Longfellow at his best wrote nothing like that, which is means it's horrible, of course. I agree with you. I wish you wouldn't. I've a sweet temper, but I can't stand being agreed with, and I'm so worried about the Osvogel. Reginald stared dismally at the biscuit tin, which now presented an unattractive array of rejected cracknels. I believe, he murmured, if I could find a woman with an unsatisfied craving for cracknels, I should marry her. What is the tragedy of the Asvogel? A-A-S-V-O-G-E-L. V-O-G-E-L is German for bird. The Osvogel, it would be. It may be Dutch, though. What is the tragedy of the Osvogel? Asked the other sympathetically. Other capitalized. Oh, simply that there's no rhyme for it. I thought about it all the time I was dressing. It's dreadfully bad for one to think whilst one's dressing. And all lunchtime, and I'm still hung up over it. I feel like those unfortunate automobilists who achieve an unenviable notoriety by coming to a hopeless stop with their cars in the most crowded thoroughfares. I'm afraid I shall have to drop the Osvogel, and it did give such a lovely local color to the thing. Still, you've got the heedless hartebeest, and quite a decorative bit of moral admonition when you've worried the meaning out. Cease war, thy bubbling madness, that the wine shares, and bid thy legions turn their swords to mine shares. Mine shares seem to fit the case better than plowshares. There's lots more about the blessings of peace. Shall I go on reading it? If I must make a choice, I think I would rather they went on with the war. I'm afraid I didn't do that one full justice, but I think you get the idea. He's making fun of this silly, goofy poetry of the times and how it's all fake, seem, rather than be. Anyway, I think that's probably enough for today. This is The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find everything that we record, all of our lectures, our discussions of Saki and everything else at vnnforum.com. We will get on and do more. There's much, much more. We've only done about 12 pages of the complete stories of Saki out of 600, roughly. And that may include a couple of novels, though. Maybe 400. And so thanks for listening. I'll be with you again real soon.